Well, by now, those of you who've been studying with me for a while know that one of the things that I feel very, very strongly about is visiting familiar scenes, visiting familiar stories, and trying to find new meaning and meaning that perhaps we've missed in the past. And Purim is a perfect example of this. Purim, I think, is a holiday that has very, very serious messages. In fact, our shiur today is probably most appropriate that we're doing it on Tanis Esther. You'll see why. It is a holiday that we often relegate in our minds to child's play, to masquerades, to games, et cetera, failing to understand the very, very serious messages that it brings. We're going to open with a question which we're not going to answer right away. At the end of the class, but by the time we get to the end of the class, hopefully the answer will have become clear. The question really is based on a discussion in the Talmud, in the Gemara, it's the first paragraph before you, and that is that by all rights, we should have been finished with Purim a month ago. The truth is that there is a very serious halachic principle, which is Ein Ma'avirin Al HaMitzvot, that if you have the opportunity to perform a mitzvah, then you are supposed to do it at the first possible opportunity given to you. Ein Ma'avirin, you do not. There's also another way of saying it, bringing Pesach into mind, Ein Machmitzin, you don't allow the mitzvah to become chametz. You do it as soon as you can. Who knows what's going to happen? This is, in fact, the position of Rabbi Eliezer Rabbi Yossi in a debate concerning when you celebrate Purim in a year like this where there are 2 months of Adar. According to Rabbi Eliezer Rabbi Yossi, Ein Ma'avirin Al HaMitzvot. And therefore, first month of Adar comes, you should have celebrated Purim already, we should have a break before Pesach, and that would have been it. Rabbi Shimon Bar Ben Gamliel, however, says no. Rabbi Shimon Ben Gamliel says, Mesamech Geula LeGeula Odif, that it's better to always keep the redemption story of Purim close to the redemption story of Pesach. And therefore, there should always be this 1 month connection between the two, and you celebrate on the second month of Adar rather than the first. And at face value, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel's position doesn't seem that strong, because the fact is that these two holidays are very, very different. They couldn't be more different. Pesach is a biblical festival. Purim is a rabbinic festival. Pesach celebrates the totality of Jewish history from its first footfalls until Yemos HaMashiach. Purim celebrates a discrete event that occurred at one particular moment of history. Why does Rav Shimon ben Gamliel's position of Mesamech Geula LeGeula Adif, that keeping these two holidays together, override the normative halachic principle of Ein Ma'avirin Al HaMitzvot? Why do we decide like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel? So that's the question. Ponder it. Put it in the back of your minds for a moment. As I said, hopefully we'll come back to it at the end of the shiur. In order to answer this question, I think we really have to go to the extreme in terms of trying to understand the messages of Purim. And the first place to begin is to peg Purim as a paradigm by noting when it occurs in Jewish history. So you have a very, very summarized timeline before you. Let's quickly look. We go through the patriarchal period, which is the first period of Jewish history before we are a nation. The nation is born in Egyptian slavery, Exodus, desert wandering, Matan Torah. We enter the land of Canaan, conquest under Joshua, Yehoshua. We experience the period of Shoftim, which is a period of no central government and tremendous chaos and difficulties over and over again. The kingdom of the Jewish people is united under three kings, and only three kings will rule over a united Jewish people so far, and those kings are Shaul, David, and Shlomo, right? Saul, David, and Solomon. After Shlomo, the kingdom splits into two. We go through a couple of centuries as a divided kingdom. And that's the period where you have the kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes, and the kingdom of Judea, the kingdom of two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. The period of divided kingdom ends when the Assyrians, at the end of number 7, the Assyrians conquer the 10 tribes, and the 10 tribes are sent into exile. So we don't know who they are. We don't know where they are. They assimilate. The Assyrians had a particular way of dealing with conquered people, and it was very wise for them. What they did was they would take a conquered people, they would move them from their land so they would no longer have an attachment to their land, and they would spread them out through their kingdom, replacing people, putting other people in other places so that there would be no ability for them to rise up, and therefore the 10 tribes are spread out through the kingdom. Today, there are those who claim to be B'nai Manasseh, others, but they're lost to Jewish history in a very, very real sense. The kingdom of Judea, which is the kingdom that gives rise to the Jew, that's why we're called Jews, because we come from the kingdom of Judea. The kingdom of Judea is ultimately conquered, not too far later, by the Babylonians. The Babylonians destroy the first Beis HaMikdash, exile the Jews to Babylon for 70 years, roughly 70 years. Now, this is a very important period in Jewish history. It's an amazing period, actually, because it's a prototype for Jews living in exile. For the first time as a nation, we are living and maintain our identity within an exile community. Because the Babylonians don't do what the Assyrians did. The Babylonians don't spread their conquered people around, and they allow us to retain communal structures. So that you have, in fact, the Gemara will talk about the Reish Galuta. The Reish Galuta is the exilarch. He's the head of the Jewish community in exile. And because we're retaining our structures, we are able to maintain our Jewish faith and our hope for return to the land of Israel. We're hoping, Al Na'arus Bavel, we're hoping to return, etc., etc. This will become the paradigm, this Babylonian exile, for the Jews surviving an exile experience. And it becomes what enables us later on to do this. After roughly 70 years, Cyrus the Great, the king of Persia, conquers the Babylonian community, conquers the Babylonian Empire. And Cyrus allows his peoples within his kingdom to return to their roots. And Cyrus therefore gives permission for the Jews to return to the land of Israel and to rebuild the temple. This is number 9, which you'll see in italics. How many Jews return? Who knows?
42,000.
Right. Less than 10%. A minimal number. Why? Why did I only come at this point in my life? Why do my relatives stay where they are? This is the period that is most like our period in Jewish history. Because this is the period where the exile of force becomes the exile of choice. That's really what's happening here. The exile of force becomes the exile of choice. And there are stops and starts in the building of the Second Temple and different waves of people going, but it is a small group that goes back to drain the swamps, but not really, but in this case, to deal with the people who are in the land, to rebuild the temple. Most Jews remain in Babylon. It is at this point that Purim occurs. Somewhere in this period, there are debates, there's the Talmudic timeline, there are others who argue, whatever, but it's somewhere within this period that Purim occurs, and it's almost like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, okay guys, if this is the life you're going to choose, let me show you what it really means. And Purim becomes the paradigm of an exile experience. And as proof of this, and that makes it like no other holiday. In other words, it's not like a other holiday where we're celebrating an event in the past. Purim occurs again and again and again and again. If you open up the Encyclopedia Judaica and you take a look at the entry for Purim, after it discusses the story of the Purim that we call Purim, you'll see a chart, a full-page chart. And this is a chart of dozens of Purims. What are these Purims? These are the Jewish community in a particular exile community experienced a near tragedy or a very horrific event, had some sort of salvation, and to mark that event, they had a holiday. And they called it the Purim of Paris, the Purim of Worms. Why? Because that's the way Purim is perceived. That's the way it should be perceived. It is a holiday that establishes what the exile experience is going to be like and what it's going to be like for your nation when most of you or a good part of your people live in exile. So it affects all of us. That's why I say that we need to peg Purim as a paradigm. We need to understand that that is what this festival is. If that's the case, the first thing we see is that in the story are woven a series of continuing realities that are very familiar to us because these realities populate our experience across the ages. Let's take a look. Number one, bottom of the page. Sentence, uvishneim asar kodesh, uchodesh adar, bishlosh asar yom, etc., etc., etc. This is when the edict of Ahasuerus, Haman's edict, is sent out. This is exactly the opposite. This pasuk is when it turns the other way. This pasuk is at the end of the Megillah. This pasuk is at the end of the Megillah, where Bnei Yisrael, where the Jews are able to defeat their enemies. The day that was meant to be the day of destruction becomes the day of salvation. And two words are written in the Megillah that are now in a song about Purim. Vinnahafoch hu. What do those words mean? It was turned around. This is the first reality. When you live in exile, things turn on a dime. Nothing is permanent. Nothing is stable. You are vulnerable, and that vulnerability can rear its head in an instant. The Purim story, Vin Nahafohu. The beginning of the story, according to the Talmud, we're celebrating in the palace of Ahasuerus. Suddenly, Haman. Suddenly, Mordechai with Big Son and Zeresh. Suddenly, the king can't sleep. Everything changes on a dime. Nothing is stable. Sound familiar? I mean, 5 years ago, if anybody would have predicted that Donald Trump would be the president of the United States, you would have laughed him out of the room. If anyone would have tried to predict what Syria would look like 10 years ago, the world changes on a dime. Friends who are your friends become your enemies. Enemies become your friends. You're talking now to the Arabs you never spoke to for decades. Who knows? That is the reality. The reality is that when your fate is in the hands of others, or particularly dictated by others, then you are living in an uncertain world and you can never be sure, any community that you're in, what tomorrow's going to bring. Next. Turn the page. Famous question in the Talmud, but a strange, strange question. Esther min HaTorah minayin. All right. Where do I know Esther from the Torah? Why is that a strange question? Esther lived thousands of years, hundreds of years after the Torah was closed, right? So what do you mean, where is Esther in the Torah? Esther's not in the Torah. So answer the rabbis. V'anochei haster astir ponai bayom hahu. Literally, what does that mean? On that day, God is warning, I will hide my face. So what do the rabbis see there? They see a play on words, right? Haster, astir, what does it sound like? Esther? Fine, nice word game. But it's much deeper than that. What are the rabbis saying? Rabbis are saying Purim is an example of hester ponim. Purim is an example of a period of time when God's not speaking anymore. All right, now for those of you who've been studying Yosef with me, will remember that we made a point that Yosef is the beginning of the non-prophetic era of the patriarchal period. Purim is the beginning of the non-prophetic era of the national period. Prophecy ends around the time of Purim. Nobody tells Mordechai what to do. Nobody tells Esther what to do. They have to figure it out for themselves. From that moment on, God's going to be working behind the scenes. He's not going to be talking to you. And you will be living, if you live in exile, in a world where God is hidden and you've got to figure out what to do. Even if you're living in Israel during a period when most of your nation or part of your nation is in exile, you're living in a period of Hester Ponim. And that's what Purim represents. It represents what's missing in the Megillah? Yep. God's name, right? Again, this none of this is by coincidence. The purpose, the thrust is to say that every one of these events could have conceivably be explained as coincidence if you didn't want to see the miracle. But look at the miracle. Look at the miracle today of Israel, of returning to a land. And how many people are blind to that miraculous event? But God is working through history. Next. This one's very strange and I think somewhat problematic because too many people take it literally. Omar Rava, Chayav Inish Livsume Bepuria Adelo Yada Bein Oror Hamon LeBaruch Mordechai. Person should become so intoxicated, Rava says, that you can no longer distinguish between blessed Aror Haman, cursed is Haman, and blessed is Mordechai. Now, as I said, this is not Halacha Lamaisa. That's not this class here, all right? The Rama, others say that you should just drink enough to fall asleep so you don't know the difference. Some of the excesses here are very upsetting. But why would the rabbi say something like this? And why would they say that you should do it so that you can no longer distinguish the difference? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's part of it. I think it's even deeper than that. Yeah?
Maybe to show that what looks good and what looks bad, so I think that there is no evil, there is no
good. Close. That's hard because there is evil and there is good, but you live in an aberrant world where the distinctions between evil and good are blurred. Right? You've got to touch that world. You've got to recognize what that world means. You've got to recognize what it means to live in a world where the UN is going to put Iran and Yemen and Libya as heads of the Human Rights Commission. Right? You gotta look at it. You've got to experience. You have to understand that you are living in a world where the distinctions made between good and evil are blurred. And what does it mean to live in that kind of world? And only when you recognize that blurring can then you begin to say, no, I'm going to distinguish. You've got to see it. You've got to experience it. That's living in Galus, right? Well, your friend's going to be your enemy tomorrow. Your enemy's going to be your friend. Who knows, right? The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, again, I'm United States citizen, from other countries, England, everything. It's blurred. Next. So my point is that on Purim, what I'm suggesting, it's an excellent question. I think you can only gain clarity when you recognize the problem. All right? Purim is a day of recognizing the problem. Purim is a day of saying, this is what it means to live in Galus. What it means to live in Galus is that good and evil is going to be blurred. I'm going to be told things and my ability to distinguish is going to be challenged. So you have to sometimes, when you are facing critical problems, you have to see the depth of the problem before you can begin to solve the problem. And I think that's what's happening here. These are all issues. These are all problems. These are all realities. Next, fragmented nation. Purim is the only festival on the Jewish calendar where from the outset, different communities are meant to celebrate at different times. All right? Amazing, isn't it? It's the only holiday. The fact is that we have Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galios, but that's not that comes later, and that's to answer a question, whatever, you can't tell when it's Rosh Chodesh. Purim is meant to be celebrated at different times for different communities. And if you look at the Mishnah, which I have before you, a fragmented nation, what you have is, the Mishnah says it's not just the 14th and 15th. But the way we used to mark it, you could celebrate on the 11th, the 12th, the 13th, the 14th, or the 15th, depending on where you lived. Because if you were in a small village and you didn't have someone to read the Megillah and you came in for the market day, you would come in and hear the Megillah on the 11th or the 12th or the 13th. Fragmented nation. That's a reality of the exile existence. Now, not... And here again, it cuts both ways. Some of the beauty of our people is that we have picked up beautiful traditions in different communities across time, etc. But that we used to be a people on our land coming together three times a year to celebrate together, right? In exile, you're celebrating differently. You're celebrating Sfardim, Ashkenazim, Litvaks, Galicianas. Now, we're living in a miraculous time where we're trying to put the pieces back together. And it's not always easy. And it's miraculous that we can do that. Again, I one of the things that to me is so telling is in Meishel and Englewood, where I was Rav, we had a very vibrant Sephardic community as part of the Ashkenazic community. We have multiple minyanim, and they have a beautiful sanctuary in the building which houses all the sanctuaries. And my Ashkenazic friends would go in and daven there periodically, and they would come out and they would say to me, it's wonderful, it's beautiful, but it's so different. And I would say to them, no, the miracle is that it's so similar. The miracle is that, yes, they sound different, but they're saying the same Shema, basically saying the same Amido with some minor changes, basically saying the same structured tefillah. We were a nation that we didn't have any communication for centuries. And now that the walls are coming down and we can recognize each other as Jews, only because we kept our traditions, that's miraculous. It's a miracle we've created. So we're a fragmented people in exile, and now we're living in a time where we're trying to put some of those pieces back together, right? Finally, the last reality that I'll mark, and again, I suggest to you that I've only found some of them. I believe there are probably many more in Purim that are realities that are paradigms for the exile existence, is one that we should feel very proud of, and that's eyes and hearts towards home. Let's understand something, and this is going to sound like Purim Torah, but it's really Gemara. And the Gemara says, or the Mishnah says, that walled cities celebrate on the 15th. Okay? So along comes the Gemara, as it always does, and the Gemara says, okay, we've got to quantify that mitzvah. What does it mean to be a walled city? When does the city have to be walled to be considered a walled city? And the Gemara answers, The Mishnah says from the time of Yehoshua bin Nun. It has to be walled from the time of Joshua. Now the Gemara comes, and the Gemara asks a question. Shushan, which is the city that you are basing the principle on, right, was not walled at the time when Joshua conquered Israel. Answers the Gemara, Shushan's an exception. Is that Purim Torah? Right? Right? Shushan's an exception. What's the Gemara saying? The Gemara is saying, wait a minute. You're celebrating a holiday in exile? You determine it by Israel. You don't determine your time by where you live in Shushan or Englewood or Teaneck or London. You determine your time by Yerushalayim. And therefore, what it is doing is it's taking this exile community and saying eyes and hearts towards home. Don't you ever think that where you are is home, that that's what determines your holidays, that that's what determines your time. Yes, and if it means that we've got to come up with a situation where the Mishnah will establish a principle where the city that is the basis of the principle will be the exception to the principle, shine. We'll do it. But we'll keep you counting by Israel, and not counting by Shushan. So these are amazing realities. These are things that are embedded into this holiday experience, some of them frightening, some of them heartwarming, like this last one, and they are saying, this is what it means to live in exile. When you choose to do it, know what you're doing. But In addition, we'll take questions at the end because I got a lot to cover. In addition to this, not only are there continuing realities, but now, if you turn to page 3, you have a paradigmatic cast of characters. Now, what do I mean by that? I want to be clear. This is a true story. These people lived. We believe that this event occurred. However, the 4 primary characters that are in this story are also paradigmatic. They are paradigms of the personalities that you will encounter across the face of history. All right, let's take the easiest one to identify. Haman. All right, so what's Haman? Give me a word. Amalek. What's Amalek? All right, so take a look at what the Megillah says about Haman. Vayibez be'enov l'shloach yad l'mordechai levado ki yigidu, etc. Vayvakesh Haman l'hashmid es kol ha'yehudim, etc. Now, a normal villain, a normal, evil, obnoxious person. Somebody refuses to bow down to him. What do? You kill the guy who doesn't bow down to you. What does Haman do? Not only am I going to kill him, but I'm going to kill all the Jews. It's irrational. It's an absolutely irrational idea. That's Amalek. Amalek is, what is the paradigm of Amalek? If you look in the Torah, the paradigm of Amalek is a nation that attacks you for no reason. You're not threatening them. You're not crossing their territory. They've got nothing to do with you, right? Asher kara lachem baderech. The word kara happened upon you. They happened upon you. It comes from the word mikre. They happened upon you. And they try to kill you. So this is paradigmatic character number 1. Meeting him again and again and again. It's amazing, isn't it? After the Shoah, we had a period of time where we lived in a bubble, where it was not fashionable to be anti-Semitic. Right? If you were anti-Semitic, it wasn't fashionable. You could do it, but keep it inside. Suddenly now, decades later, look what's happening again. What have we done to these people who hate us? What is it that creates this, as many people say, the oldest hatred in the world? And yet look how it spreads like a virus across the world. That's Haman. Next, Mordechai. Okay, so Mordechai at face value seems very, very simple. Mordechai is what? What would you say is the paradigm of the Jewish what? Hero. The hero. He's the hero. He's the leader. But let's look at what happens here. Kol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech korim u'mishtachavim lo-Haman. Everybody is bowing down to Haman. Ki kein tziva lo ha-melech. Because this is what the king commanded. U'mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachavim. I'm going to raise a question that the Talmud raises. It's not my question. Halachically, should Mordechai have bowed down to Haman? Yes. According to Jewish law, if you live in a kingdom and there's a king, and the king passes, you bow down to the king. If the king tells you to bow down to the viceroy, you bow down to the viceroy. So the Gemara says, why is Mordechai eventually jeopardizing the Jewish nation by refusing to bow down to Haman? And the Talmud gives an interesting answer, which you can take literally, but I also think you can take figuratively. No. Nuvu about what?
That Haman was a Russian.
Well, okay. So I'll go a little further. That's not what the Gemara says. What the Gemara says is that Haman wore Avodah Zorah around his neck. That he had Avodah Zorah. And therefore, you could not bow down to Haman because you were bowing down to the idolatry. But what I think the Gemara is really saying is close to what you're saying. Mordechai, and there are all sorts of midrashim about this, Mordechai knew Haman. I cannot bow down to that man. That's the point. This is my red line. I know the law, I know the halacha, but if I bow down to this man, then I am crossing a line that will haunt me and my people across the centuries, because I'll be making compromises with my own ethics and my own morality. Mordechai is the paradigm of the Jew who has to draw the red line, right? Of the leader who has to draw the red line. And by the way, all of us have to do the same, especially in a world like ours, where things are invading our home. Where, what are our red lines? What do we allow our children to see? What do we allow our children to read? What do we allow ourselves to see? What are the things that when we, if we bow down to them, conspicuous consumption, whatever else it is, we bow down to that, then that sells our soul. Mordechai makes a decision that threatens the Jewish people physically, because he believes that if you bow down to Haman, then you will threaten the Jewish people spiritually. And he knows that that eventually will lead to a worse fate. So whether it's Nevuah or whether he knows him, he refuses to bow down, in spite of the halacha. Apparently, whatever it was enough to drive Haman crazy, right? And apparently, it doesn't take much to drive an anti-Semite crazy, right? Whoever, it's one man. Look, you know, it's interesting. It's human nature. Lahavdil, I hope, Elif Havdolos, right? I was a rabbi in a large congregation. I could walk into a shul with hundreds of people, and most of them were my supporters. I could find the one guy who I knew was giving me a hard time, and I'd be focusing on that guy, right? You know, you just, it's like an irritant. It's an irritant to Haman. Everybody's bowing down to me except this guy, right? So like I said, a normal evil person says, okay, so let's get rid of this guy. He says, get rid of the Jews. Next, Esther. What is Esther the paradigm of? What would you say? She is a martyr. She's the paradigm of the Jewish martyr. All right? Let's understand. You know, we're all celebrating. We're all celebrating out in the streets of Shushan. And where's Esther? She stays in the palace of Ahasuerus. Where will she be tomorrow? She's going to meet. And there is a pasuk in the Megillah which, according to the Talmud, underscores this. Look at the pasuk. This is where Mordechai convinces her to go to the king after she says, I can't, right? And she says, gather all the Jews, et cetera, et cetera. Have them fast. This is why we have Tanis Esther. And then she says, the last few words are, Kaasher ovadeti, ovadeti. As I am lost, I will be lost. Now, what does that mean? So the rabbis say something very powerful here. The rabbis say it's not just that she's afraid she's going to lose her life. She says to Mordechai, this is the first time that I am going to the king of my own volition. This is the first time that I'm not being forced. And let's understand, again, we sanitize the story. If she's going to the king, it's not for tea and crumpets, right? It's she is a member of the harem, and she's going to the king. So she is saying to Mordechai, once I cross this line, I'm lost. I am giving my life, I'm giving my heart to save the Jewish people, yes. That's correct. There is a Talmudic tradition that they were married and et cetera, et cetera. Correct. There's a whole discussion. By the way, you should know the Talmud is very honest. The Talmud has a whole discussion about whether Esther had the right to even go to the palace in the first place and put herself into the position she put her in. It should have been maybe some Gilui Arayos. Gilui Arayos are one of the first. Sexual immorality is one of the three things you're supposed to give your life for. So what gave her the right, especially if she's married to Mordechai, to go to the king in the first place? But that's put that aside now. Let's not discuss that. The point that I'm saying is we meet Esther across history. How many times, how many Jews have had to sacrifice themselves for the better, for the greater good? That's Esther. But my favorite, because again, it's under the surface, and my favorite in a very negative way, is Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus, the person that we learned was the simpleton, right? Ahasuerus, this roly-poly king who doesn't know what, you know, doesn't know what hit him or what he's manipulated by everybody. The Talmud has a debate. One position says Ahasuerus pikeachoyo. Ahasuerus was cunning, and one says he was tipesh. All right, I believe he was crazy like a fox. What do I mean by that? Ahasuerus makes himself appear simple, but he has a fundamental drive for one thing, and that is, and we encountered this with Paro, I only care what happens in the palace. What happens outside my walls couldn't bother me. And if I can take care of problems, there are those who say he hated the Jews more than Haman. If he'll take care of that problem for me, even better. Just don't let it come here. Here, what is here? Party, happiness, light, joy. That's Ahasuerus. And he is the paradigm of the immoral monarch who is willing to sacrifice anything for his own protection and his own safety. Let's see, and I'll prove it to you from the Megillah. Let's start with number one, section four, number one. Haratzim yatzu dechufim bidvar ha-melech vados nitna b'shushan ha-bira. This is what I thought I was talking about before. V'ha-melech v'haman yashru lishtos v'ayir shushan navocha. Look at that last line. Haman v'ha-melech yashru lishtos v'ayir shushan navocha. The edict went out, and it doesn't say the Jews were perplexed, bewildered. Navocha is even more powerful than that. They were astounded. The ir Shushan Navocha. And where are Maman and the Melech? They're sitting and drinking. Now, why is Shushan going crazy? Because what the king just did is crazy. Imagine for a moment you turn to a country and say, okay, we're setting a date. At this particular date, you can kill you. Now go ahead and live for the next 6 months. What do I do? My neighbor's going to kill me in 6 months. Do I ask her for sugar today? Are we still neighbors? How do I live? How do I live with this reality hanging over my head for months? Haman v'hamelech, it's like throwing a grenade out into the street, and I'm sitting and having a party. Next. Gets better. Vayavo ad lifnei hashar ha-melech. This is Mordechai. Mordechai is coming to the king. He's coming towards the king. What's he wearing? Sackcloth. Ki ein lavo el shar ha-melech bilvush sack. I'm not allowed to come into the king's gate with sackcloth. Why? It's not just I can't wear dungarees or jeans when I come to see the king. It's don't you bring your problems into the gate. You have a problem? Stay there. Outside. There were points in history where there were benevolent monarchs, right? Where they would have audiences with their population and people would bring problems to the king. Not Ahasuerus. You're wearing sackcloth? You don't come in here. Next. Something that we all know to be a reality of the Megillah, and again, we accept it without even stopping. Mordechai goes to Esther and says, you got to go see the king. She says, no, I can't. Why? Why? Because you have to, the king, the only people who can see the king on any particular day are the people the king wants to see. If you show up and he doesn't want to see you, he's going to kill you. Wouldn't it be nice to wake up in the morning and say, okay, the only people I want to see today are the following list, right? They're the only ones that I want to see. I don't want to see anybody else, and anybody else who I see, I'm just going to kill. Where does that come from? If a minister has to bring to him a problem with one of the provinces in India, what's he going to do? He can't go see him. He can't go see him. The king has to call him, otherwise he'll be killed. I'm creating a world that's a bubble. I'm living in a world that I'm only going to see who I want. Let's go on. The more you try to keep this world going, the more paranoid you become. Why? Because it's harder and harder to keep the outside world away. So what happens? The king can't sleep. So what does the king do? Next sentence. He has people read him bedtime stories. Right? Imagine this, right? I wake up in the middle of the night. This can't happen. So come. You know, somebody's going to read me. And you're going to read for me from the book that tells all the great things that I've done. Right? But the real evil, where this hits its culmination, is in the last part of the drama. Take a look at the bottom. You're at the second party. Esther says, someone's out to kill me and my people. Ahasuerus says, mi huzev ezehu. Esther says, Haman hara hazeh, right? This Haman, this horrible Haman. What's the first thing the king does? He runs away. He runs out of the room. What's that about? It's the worst nightmare the king can ever have, right? The outside world has just come crashing down. So he runs out of the room. He comes back into the room. He finds Esther, he finds Haman prostrating himself on Esther's bed. What does he say to her? What does he say to Haman? Are you trying to seduce the queen? Now let's understand something, and I mean this facetiously. Men are animals, but do we really believe that Haman is trying to seduce Esther right now, that's what he has on his mind? Do I really believe that Ahasuerus thinks that Haman is seducing Esther? No, what's he doing? He's redefining the situation, thank you. He is saying, I got to take care of the problem. Well, that's a huge problem, but this is an easy problem. He's trying to seduce my wife. What do? Kill him. Shine. And what? Once I kill him, then what? Then I've taken care of the problem, right? V'kamas ha-melech shachocho. And turn the page. What has to happen? Esther has to come back and look at what she does. V'tosef Esther v'tadaber lifnei ha-melech v'tipo lifnei raglov. She begs and she cries and she screams and she says, hey, buddy, you're not finished. This is the most miraculous moment of the Megillah. Why? Because what Esther is saying to the king is, hey, husband, I'm not going to leave you alone for a minute. So you can, and therefore, what would Ahasuerus normally do under those conditions? Kill her, right? He just what? Been there, done that is right. Okay, but he's so in love with this woman, or so enamored, or so in lust, or whatever it might be, that he doesn't want to kill Esther. That's miraculous. That's an Ace Nistar. So what does he do? And here comes the culminating moment of Ahasuerus's character. What does he do? He says, I can't withdraw the decree. Why? Why not? Kings don't make mistakes. I don't make mistakes. So what will I do? I'll issue a second decree. What's the second decree? The Jews can fight back. Do you know what the king has just done? He's just instituted civil war in his kingdom. I mean, we read this. We don't pay attention to it. He's just said, okay, guys, on the 14th of Adar, go kill each other. You kill them. Have a good time. Pox on both your houses here in Shushan. Do it on the 15th. On the 13th. Sorry. It's the 13th of Adar because we celebrate on the 14th. And in Shushan, it's on the 14th you can do it, right? And go ahead. Just don't go. Have a good time. The king doesn't care. Can you believe? Can you see what's happening here? So what is Ahasuerus the paradigm of? An uncaring world. It's the paradigm of every monarch and every leader and every country that doesn't care what happens outside its borders. It's a paradigm of the world during the Shoah. It's a paradigm of other events like that. And what we are learning is that Haman cannot exist unless he's in the world of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is the backdrop that allows Haman to exist. Can't do it unless the world leaves you alone. So look at this. Look at these characters. They are real people, but every single one of them is a paradigm to what we will encounter across the face of history. It's amazing. And now, take a look at number four, which is the last piece of all this. And that is, we noted realities and we noted characters. It comes together at one frightening moment in the Megillah. And in some ways, I think this is the most frightening moment of the Megillah. When Mordecai goes to Esther and says, you have to go to the king, how does he begin his argument? What does he say to her as a first argument? Al tedami b'nafsheich lihimoleit beis hamelech mikol hayehudim. Put that in your own words. Look at the English. What is he saying to her? Don't think you're safe. Now, wow. Is that how I would expect Mordecai to speak to Esther? I would expect him to go, what do you mean you can't go? Your brothers and sisters are going to be killed. How can you not go? Don't think you're safe. So I'd like to suggest that Mordecai is afraid. There is a fundamental truth. When you live in the world of Ahasuerus, there are two dangers. One is you become the victim. What's the other? You become the perpetrator. You become, little by little, you change and you don't realize you're changing. Mordecai is going to Esther in the palace of Ahasuerus, and he's afraid. So he starts off with, don't think you're safe, when she says no. There's a famous story by Elie Wiesel, which talks about a just man coming to Sodom. And the just man comes to Sodom, and as soon as he gets there, he starts screaming about what he's seeing. He starts arguing and protesting. He does this one day, 2 days, 3 days, year in year. He does it for 30 years. At the end of 30 years, a little boy comes up to him and says, you foolish man, don't you see you haven't made a dent? You haven't made a difference? So Wiesel says, beautifully, the just man turns to the boy and says, when I first came here, I was screaming to change them. Now I'm screaming to stop them from changing me. That's what we're being told here. We're living in the world of Ahasuerus. Don't lose your morality. Don't lose your ethics. Don't lose who you are. And this is not easy. We see this happen. We see this struggle in our own country now, here in Israel. What are the lines? What are the ethics? What can we do? What can't we do? How can we do it? And that struggle, that ethical struggle, is what makes us who we are. It's when you stop having that struggle. It's when you stop asking those questions. It's when you are comfortable doing things that you wouldn't have been comfortable doing, and you've changed. That's when you've lost the battle. All right. We finally close, and then I'll take any questions. We'll finally close with that opening question that I asked you, and you probably don't remember it, which is, why do we celebrate Purim during the second month of Adar, not during the first? I believe what Rav Shimon ben Gamliel is saying is you have to celebrate your experience in the light of Jewish history. This paradigmatic festival only becomes a paradigm when it's celebrated in the shadow of Pesach. It is only a holiday. It only became a holiday when Mordecai and Esther said, you know what? This didn't just happen to us. This is a story for the ages. This is part of the unfolding Jewish tale. This is part of the and every generation and every community has to celebrate its Purim in the shadow of Pesach. And that's why those two have to be close, so that Purim can serve as a paradigm for what we will expect across the face of history. Okay, questions? Well, that's a whole different thing. In other words, we weren't sure of what the date was. That's how that developed. We were trying to celebrate like Israel, but we couldn't peg it. So we did two just to be sure. And now the question I most often received as a rabbi over the course of my years was, why do we celebrate now the second day of Yontif, right? And the answer, I understand, is, and it's part of our discussion here, that when you live in Galus, you should always feel like you'll never know the date. You never know. You'll never know when you might find yourself in a position where you won't know the date. And by the way, 70 years ago, there were Jews in that position, right? Who didn't know the dates because and had to determine in Auschwitz what the date was. You never know. You never know. And therefore, if you're living in Galus, you keep celebrating that second day. And maybe it's a good incentive for people to make Aliyah. All right? Any other question? Okay, thank you very much. A meaningful fast and a Freilich and a Purim Sameach.